Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks for listening to the Not A Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
This is Not A Diving podcast. With Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not A Diving podcast. Yeah, welcome back. Welcome if you're a new listener, perhaps a new returning listener from last week with Alex Patterson. That was a very popular episode, actually. And I think lots of people listen to that episode that haven't listened to the show before. And I've got a good few messages, people reaching out saying how nicely surprised they were to discover a podcast. Obviously, we've been going for over 100 episodes, so we're not really new at all, really. But, you know, if you're new to the program, if you're getting yourself up to speed, then yeah, welcome, welcome. And I'm glad you enjoyed yourself last week, and I hope you're going to enjoy yourself this week too. Definitely. So, just before we get started with our guests, you would have heard at the top that you can get rid of the ads by supporting the show on Patreon. Now, supporting us on Patreon does not just get rid of ads. You get different and additional stuff too. So, for example, on this episode, the Patreon-sponsored version of this episode is about 20 minutes longer because I did a extended introduction detailing my thoughts on Dune 2 and specifically the score to Dune 2, which, spoiler alert, I think is really not that great, to be honest. And also, I did a bit of a deep dive on comparing the global music market with the global football market. Now, that sounds interesting, doesn't it? Or maybe your eyes have already glazed over. But that's the kind of thing that I find interesting. So that was, I'd say, not typical of a Patreon episode. Additionally to that, there are bonus episodes that go up. And also, if you support us on the musicality tier, then you will be receiving all of the music that we release on Hot Flush Recordings and affiliated labels. So patreon.com/scubaofficial is the place to go to do that. If you're liking the show but don't want to subscribe, you can also contribute via scubaofficial.io/support. There's a number of options there to support us. And if you're not willing or able to support financially, then, well, there's a ton of stuff you can do too. Follow the show wherever you listen to this episode and leave us a review. Reviews are now important again on podcasting platform algorithms. So yeah, hit the five-star button and leave some kind of gushing prose in praise of the Not Diving podcast. And, you know, I do enjoy reading that stuff as well. So so yeah, please do. Anyway, let's get on with the show this week, shall we? Monty Luke is a really great DJ and producer from the United States. He's a former label manager of Carl Craig's Planet E Communications. So he has been around the block a few times, and yeah, he's got some really interesting stories to tell, including stories from the Sunset Strip and the hair metal scene in the 1980s. Now, I didn't realize that these stories were going to be available when I asked Monty to come on the show, but they are, and they're, well, that made this episode for me, I have to say. Spoiler alert, that is a moment in history that I really wish I'd been around for. But, you know, got to live it vicariously through other people. And absolutely, I do on this episode. So, yeah, enjoy it with me. Live it vicariously with me. And, yeah, let's just get on with it, shall we? Just a couple more things. There's a Spotify playlist that you can follow, which contains all the episodes and much of the music that we talk about on the show. There's a link to that playlist in the show notes. And also, we'd love to see you in our Discord server. Hotflushrecordings.com/Discord gets you through to that server. There's a private area for supporters. But even if you're not a supporter, you can get through to the server and have a chat with the lots of nice people in there who congregate every week to, yeah, talk about the show and other things besides. So yeah, we would love to have you in there. Hotflushrecordings.com/Discord. And without further delay, here is Monty Luke. Monty Luke, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Absolutely. So I've been listening to your two-part EP on Records this morning. It's awesome. Really, really great work.
Thanks.
Tell me, to what extent is this an album? Because it's an album's worth of material, essentially, but obviously it's split into two EPs, and you are an album artist. You've released albums previously. So tell me about how this differentiates itself, if at all, from your previous album projects.
Well, no, it's going to be an album project. So they've decided to split it into two EPs, and then on the 29th, or roughly thereabouts, the full album, which is 14 tracks, is going to be released. So yeah, there's like an additional like five tracks that haven't been released yet.
Got it. Okay. Well, I haven't had the privilege of hearing those tunes, unfortunately. But yeah, so tell me about the project in totality then, because, you know, your previous album projects are really great pieces of work. So yeah, tell me about how this differs, if at all, and, you know, what was the process and all the rest of it?
Yeah, I mean, but basically, like, this record, I mean, like, Night Dubbing differs from, like, my last album was just as Monty Luke was called Hard Work, Not Hype.
Yeah.
And when I really look back at that record now, that was really more of a synopsis of my 10 years living in Detroit. It was almost like a report when I look back at it now. It wasn't intended to be that way, like when I was doing it, but like now that I look back, it was like kind of like, it kind of was like, that's how it is. But Night Dubbing is different, because Night Dubbing is more like, I think it's just more reflective of like, who I am and where I have been and what I'm into musically. I don't know if that is, I don't know if I explained that correctly, but like, dub music has always been, since I was born, pretty much like a part of my musical upbringing. And, yeah, it just is one of those things that just kind of came out. And, I just started working on a couple tracks, and then I kind of came up with this cheeky title for it, because I was always been super into the Grace Jones album Nightclubbing. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah, I just grew out of that.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, well, we are in the third year of this podcast now, and I spent most of the first year of it asking people about the album format itself, mm-hmm. and whether it even makes sense to release an album, you know, that kind of question, you know, the one that's coming, right? So, yeah, so tell me about how you feel about albums generally, because obviously as dance music producers, this is a genre which lends itself to singles, obviously.
Yeah.
But how do you think about albums as an artist?
I feel like, as DJs and as electronic music producers, there's the single used to be important. I don't know how important it still is. I notice that a lot of people these days, there's this strategy where people are just releasing one track,
right,
rather than like an EP of like two or three or four tracks. I notice people are just releasing straight up just one, you know, at a time. And I do feel like the album format is important. I think it's actually more important than it has been ever, because I feel like because there's so much music coming out, because there are so many artists that are, you know, now engaged and like, you know, releasing music on a regular basis, I think the album actually is a way for artists to actually stand out. Because, you know, like I said, like, you know, I mean, I have an inbox full of promos. Many of them are like just people who are just releasing one track at a time, you know, but not many are releasing, you know, a set of 8, 10 or 12 with a conceptual sort of like, you know, under some sort of conceptual sort of rubric, you know. So, yeah, I do think it is actually really important. I think it's more important than ever.
That's an answer that I can imagine myself giving. And I think about it from, I think about it, you know, from the perspective of a producer, you know, the perspective of a musician. But I know you also run a label too. And obviously this is coming out on records. It's not coming out on your label. But from the perspective of, you know, the cold-hearted record label owner, And you talked about, you know, releasing single tracks, and obviously that's driven by the needs of, you know, the streaming platforms and the way people get their music now through those platforms. Like, from a business perspective, do you have a different answer to that question, I suppose, is my what I'm asking?
Man, I mean, I'm the wrong guy to be asking about label business stuff, because, like, I just put out whatever. But no, I think, you know, if an artist came to me with a story to tell, and, you know, this was like, you know, a project that they really felt strongly about, and it wasn't just like a bunch of tracks put together, I would definitely be interested in, you know, I'd be excited about releasing it for them, you know. You know, I think, you know, when I look and see, you know, because Records, obviously, what Records is doing versus what I do with Black Catalog are on completely different levels, you know. So it has been interesting seeing how a label like Records deals with an album project, you know, because I can put a single out in my sleep. I can, you know, release a 12-inch in my sleep. But, you know, it really, I've learned that it really is a different animal, the sort of like what you, the right way to be handling an artist's album, you know. So yeah, I definitely would, I definitely wouldn't hesitate, putting out someone's album on my own label, but I definitely, it's a different ball game from just, you know, releasing a single or something that's digital only, you know. I think it's really important to sort of like, to craft a story around what the artist is trying to do and sort of like be strategic about, you know, how to roll it out. And I think it's very important when you do that with respect to releasing an album.
Yeah, sorry, if you could hear my cat in the background there, he's just going completely crazy. I've just had to throw him out.
I can't hear anything, actually.
Oh, okay, that's good. Yeah, because he's, yeah. Anyway, okay, so this is a question. To what extent are you deliberately playing down your label knowledge? Because you used to, of course, work for Planet E, and I think you basically ran Planet E as a label for a number of years,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, 6 years.
So are you deliberately playing down your industry knowledge there?
No, actually, I don't feel like I am. I mean, I consider myself somebody who is like constantly learning and like trying to, you know, better myself and better what I'm doing. So I wouldn't say that like I have learned so much about the album releasing process from, you know, my experience with Records,
sure,
you know, and with Dean, with respect to the promotion, you know, promotion side of things. Yeah, I mean, I think with Planet E and sort of what I do at Black Catalog, Planet E and labels like that, I think a run off of the label owner's gut more so than like, you know, the business.
Right.
And that's basically, you know, working at Planet E taught me how to run a label. So that's probably why my label is run more so on gut feelings and instinct than it is on actual business.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely hear you. And I think that's true for the vast majority of dance labels. And I think that's partly why the kind of label ecosystem in the dance scene is so important, you know, because it's actually an extension of the, kind of, I guess, artistic temperaments of the people who run them, which are, you know, usually, not always, but usually producers themselves. And it's, I guess, another string to that artistic bow, if I can put it like that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's just, you know, all these different ways to how they say, skin a cat, you know?
Right.
You know, there's the, there's sort of the Black Catalog way of doing it, which is like, anytime the sort of like spirit strikes me and I run across something that I really like, I'll put it out. Then there's, you know, the level of like a Records or Shall Not Fade, where, you know, there's this like consistent sort of plan and there's like, you know, many, 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 many releases coming out over the course of a year, you know. Or there's the sort of like exclusivity of a Geegling, is that how you pronounce it? And sort of how they do things, you know. These things are still sort of, you know, there isn't just one way to do it, you know. And I think there is still some room for labels to be successful, you know, obviously things have gotten a little bit more challenging over the years with respect to distribution and revenue and that kind of thing. But I do think that, you know, there's quite a few labels out there that have been able to find quite a bit of success with what they're doing, and being able to stay true to what they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a well-run label can really add a lot. I mean, you've just given a really good description of an example of that, right? Because, you know, even producers who are really experienced, not just in producing, but also in releasing records, it is a different thing. You're absolutely right to say that, you know, an album campaign, I think particularly now, and particularly actually in the context of the pace of change that there is in the industry, it's almost like doing an album campaign now is pretty different to what it was like 5 years ago, or even 2 years ago. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we talk about, well, I've been having conversations with, is the importance of SoundCloud, which like completely went away for seemingly like quite a long time and is now apparently a really important platform again. So it's just, keep you in touch with, apparently so. That's what people say now. Yeah.
Like in what way?
In music discovery. This is the word. I had a
with
very...
electronic music.
Yeah. Hmm. So I had exactly the same reaction that you have had when I was first informed of this. But yeah, apparently it's this is what people are saying.
Huh.
It's now a very significant thing again. And particularly, like I said, with music discovery, because I mean, music discovery is a topic of conversation that we've dug into quite a bit on this podcast. And, you know, it's hard, you know, I think it's one of the major challenges that musicians face. And I think particularly new musicians, new producers making this kind of stuff, just getting heard is the hardest, you know, it's the biggest hurdle, I think, for new producers. So yeah, SoundCloud, yeah. But it's an example of things changing at just a breakneck speed, you know, and the necessity to be, I guess, nimble. And a really good label, a really well-run label, I think can add that kind of value, right? As I said, you've just given a great example of it. So
is that SoundCloud thing, is that like hype because like somebody's trying to sell them for like $1 billion, so they're just kind of spreading that around? Because I'm gonna have to investigate that a little bit more, that it's become more prominent.
I mean, it predates that news story for sure. I mean,
interesting.
Like I said, I was surprised to hear that initially, but you know, having kind of like gone into it in a bit more detail, yeah, it is significant. But I think it's significant in the context of just how difficult it is to be discovered.
You know?
So people, I think, are just looking for different, you know, methods and looking for different avenues.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's wild out there. It is straight up wild. I mean, I'm sure you know, you know, I always tell my friends that are not in the industry who are, you know, music heads, you know, I always blow their minds when I quote them that number that, you know, like how many new tracks are being released every single day, like on services
right.
like Spotify, and how that's, you know, anticipated to increase even more with AI, you know, and like they're always blown away. It's like 100,000 a day. And I'm like, yeah. It used to be, I remember a few years ago, it was like 40,000.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I guess I think that's, you know, there's obviously been the recent thing that Spotify in particular have put out, well, have announced saying that they're going to demonetize tracks performing below a certain threshold. And there was obviously quite a lot of outrage that followed that announcement. But, you know, the context of it is that the vast majority of music that gets uploaded to their platform, it's either bits of white noise or bits of ASMR or like, do you know what I mean? Just stuff which is just clogging up the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the way their payment system works means like, you know, it's actually, will actually be, I think, I'm sort of cautiously optimistic about that particular thing. But that's another example of just things changing super quickly. But let me ask you though, I was digging into your backstory earlier on when I was preparing for this. You're not from the Bay Area, but you had a significant period of your life spent there. Is that right?
Yeah. After I graduated from uni, I went to the University of California at Santa Barbara. I grew up in Los Angeles, but then I went to uni in Santa Barbara, which is sort of like almost like the halfway point between the Bay Area and LA. But I spent 13 years, really formative years, actually, in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and I was reading that you were one of the early employees of AskJeeves.com, right?
Did Dean tell you to bring that up? Because I brought that up in a meeting we had.
No.
Yeah, dude, I was employee number 18 at Ask Jeeves. And,
wow. Okay. So that's like the original dot-com bubble, right?
Yeah, that was dot-com bubble phase one.
Right.
That was a wild, wild time, man. On paper, I was what they used to call a paper millionaire. So I had,
really? Wow.
I had stock options, worth in excess of $1 million. But you know, as you probably know, the way that, you know, companies handle the options is, you know, there's a vesting period. And so even though you're awarded these options at a certain price and then they go on sale at a certain price, you're not allowed to sell them for like X amount of years, usually 4. So by the time I was able to actually sell them, I definitely was not a millionaire.
Tell me what the atmosphere was like in San Francisco at the height of that particular dot-com bubble.
I mean, if you really think about it, that was 98 through like 2001.
Yeah.
And so really it was like early days of the internet. So, you know, actually it's funny. I just saw YouTube wanted me to watch, a BBC, there used to be a show on BBC called Future or something like that. And, YouTube wanted me to watch a clip from that, which was like, them talking about the internet. It was from 1994. And, if you think about that, I mean, that was the very beginning of what we know as the internet is 1994. So 4 years later, was the sort of first gold rush. It was a crazy time. I was like, I had actually worked for a couple of America Online affiliates prior to getting that job at Ask Jeeves, and as a sort of what they used to call a content editor, content creator, and then the job that I got at Jeeves was also related to entertainment content. It was a very exciting time for sure. And it was also one of those things where it was like, is this really like for right. real? Like this company just got valued at like $1 billion. And for what, you know, like how do we even make money? You know?
Right.
You know, and it was a very exciting time because, you know, the Bay Area was also already like a hotbed, you know, as being Silicon Valley. You know, there was huge companies like Sun Microsystems and Cisco and things like that that had already been, you know, ensconced in that area and creating, an industry, a technology industry. So when sort of the web became a thing and .com became a thing, it just added to, you know, what became known as Silicon Valley. It was a crazy time, crazy hella startups like all over the place, and like, you know, lots and lots of people moving to the area and lots of money, and obviously lots and lots of gentrification and all the things that come along with that. Yeah, they at one point they sent me to open up their London office. I was living in a flat in Soho. Above Bar Italia on Frith Street.
Oh, no way, really? Wow.
Yeah, okay. Right across from Ronnie Scott's. And dude, the rent on that place was £1,600 a month. And the company paid that, and they paid me my salary plus a per diem because I was like working offsite in like another country. So like by law, I had to be paid like a per diem. So, I mean, it was just, dude, I was every weekend, I was going record shopping. I was in music and tape exchange. I was like in every single record store around there in West London, you know, in central London that you can imagine. It was just, it was a crazy time.
Amazing record shops in that era.
Yeah, totally, man. Release the Groove. Let's see who else. Just so many.
Yeah, Black Market and Uptown and those ones.
Oh, yeah, Black Market. Yeah, totally. Yep.
So, sorry, how long were you there for in London?
It was about 6 months. So I was there for 6 months. They actually asked me to stay.
Right.
But I was like, you know, I got some buddies back. I was like, you know, I was still so into music. I brought my turntables out there and everything while I was living there. But like, you know, they asked me to stay for longer. But I was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to go back to the Bay Area because I want to, you know, I want to continue doing music. I had a crew that I was working with and we were throwing events and stuff like that. And I just felt like I needed to do that. So I left and someone replaced me. But that person ended up getting laid off about a year later anyway. So I think I would have only stayed there for a short amount of time.
Right. Yeah, sure. Okay. So, yeah, you were born in LA. Is that right?
I was actually born in Brooklyn. Spent my first 5 years there. And then my mom and I moved to Los Angeles where I grew up.
Okay, right. Yeah. So tell me about getting into music in the first place. Like what were your kind of formative musical experiences?
Well, as it turns out, my dad was a event promoter in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So both of my parents are originally from Guyana. In South America, which was a, as you probably know, a British Commonwealth. And they did know each other in Guyana, but they didn't really link up until they were both in New York. You probably know that, like, specifically Brooklyn was like there's a huge sort of West Indian expat, Caribbean expat community in Brooklyn. And so I guess, you know, my parents both ended up there as a soft landing of sorts. My mom had actually spent some time, actually many years in England, becoming a nurse and working in England as a nurse, and then moved to New York. And that's where she linked up with my dad, who had been promoting events like reggae, soca events. And when they split up and my mom and I moved to LA, somehow we ended up with like a huge amount of his records. And dude, that's basically how it started.
Were there any records in particular that you remember standing out to you as a, you know, when you were that young?
Absolutely. So in that pile of records was Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On, the album. That's one of the main albums I remember. He also had a bunch of jazz on Verve albums, Cal Jader, Wes Montgomery, and then there was all these 7-inch excuse me, there was all these 45s, and there was a lot of like reggae and ska and rock steady 45s in that pile. Let me see if I can think of any offhand. There was that one really infamous track called Punani. I remember listening to that as like a really young kid, like not really knowing that what that was all about until later on. God, what else was in there? There was a bunch of like James Brown and Fred Wesley and the JB's 45s in that pile. I still have all of these, by the way. I'm trying to think more of the reggae stuff that was in there. I can't remember. There was a very early copy of Lively Up Yourself by Bob Marley and the Wailers. It was like a rock steady version of it.
Right.
Nice. Just all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah. Very cool. So as a kid, did you play instruments and stuff? Were you involved in music to that extent?
Yeah. As a young kid in like junior high, I played the cornet, which is like the small trumpet. And then later on in high school, I joined my high school drum line. And so played the drums, played the cymbals actually as a part of a competitive drum line, because I wasn't good enough to play the snare in that particular group. But but had been taking drum lessons and stuff like that all throughout that time.
I always wished that I'd been allowed to play the drums as a kid. That's kind of like my biggest regret in life, to be honest, is not being allowed to play a drum set.
Recently, I was nerding out on YouTube and I found some videos of, I was super into, like classic rock. And somehow there's like, sometimes when you watch a video on YouTube, then YouTube wants you to watch a bunch of more of the same thing, you know? And there was a video from Genesis that came up, a live video from Genesis. And the guy that used to play alongside Phil Collins, Chester Thompson, had a drum cat. Do you know what that is?
No, what is that?
The drum cat is this like really well-known, like it's like a drum pad. And it's like you use it basically as a, like a MIDI controller for drum sounds.
Right, so it's like a trigger pad kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like a trigger pad thing. And somebody in the comments was like, yeah, he's using the drum cat. It's like the most incredible like drum like module ever made. And then I was, because I had seen it before, like it looked familiar, but I just never really paid attention to it. And actually, I think Carl might have had one of those in his studio. And that's what I recognized it from anyway. So I just looked up a few videos, man. And like, there's just all these really cool videos of this drum cat thing. And it really reminded me of like learning how to play drums back in the days. And it like, was like, you know, just a really cool thing. But those things are like, actually like really coveted. They're like really durable. And there's a, you know, they don't really make them brand new anymore, but there's a company that like will refurbish them for you. And like, yeah, like tons of drummers still use them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing music kit made in that era, wasn't there? So did you play in bands as well? Did you play drums in bands?
No, it was never that good. I was always just like learning how to do it. You know, I was never good enough to play in a band.
Okay. What year are we roughly in when you're talking about playing on the line?
So that was high school. So that was like 86, 87.
Okay. So you're a few years older than me, but not that many.
Yeah.
So in fact, this is actually interesting because we've had a few accounts of the early rave scene in various different parts of the world actually mm-hmm. on the show before, but never really on the West Coast. So what are your early memories of raves starting, generally speaking, kind of that kind of music popping up and becoming visible?
Yeah,
what's your kind of earliest memory of that?
So I started DJing when I was around 18, like officially. Prior to that, I had been sort of informally doing it, like making mixtapes for friends and like bringing sort of one turntable and one CD player to like friends' birthday parties and things like that. But around 18 is when I had my first like real DJ gig. And, at that time I was mostly playing hip hop, but you know, there were some like club hits that were obviously like, must plays, like, you know, Inner City, Good Life, Big Fun. Sort of some of the more up-tempo hip-hop stuff, things like that. So this is like, you know, when I'm 18, that's 88. So do you remember Herb Magazine?
Yeah.
So
yeah, we did. I mean, not of a time, but I know of it for sure.
So Herb was like, you know, I'd pick up, you know, I'd go down to Melrose Avenue to like buy records or whatever, and I'd pick up a copy of Herb. And Herb was always talking about these like underground parties that had been happening. And like every so often, like they were always kind of oblique about like where they happened and like what was actually going on there. But like they were talking about these parties that were happening in LA. Right. And, yeah, I was at that point, I was like a little bit too young and like didn't know anyone who was also going to those parties. So I never went. So I had the awareness, definitely was already aware of the music, but I didn't actually go to any at that point. However, after I started sort of officially DJing, and then I moved to Santa Barbara to go to school. And I guess that was like 89, 90. That's when I sort of linked up with some people that also were into this music. And then we started driving down actually to LA, which is only about an hour, hour and 15 minutes to go to parties down there. So this is like, you know, late, very, very late 80s, beginning of like 1990 or so, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So actually, maybe wait, because I went 2 years before I went to UCSB. I spent 2 years at City College, so this would be like 1991-92. So that's sort of when I started. But yeah, I mean, I was totally aware of what was going on, but there was a few years in there where I actually didn't go to any of the parties because I didn't know anyone that was also going, and I was kind of young. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So LA in this era, I mean, my brain just goes immediately to the kind of hair metal bands on the Sunset Strip.
Oh right? My God. Right?
Completely cliched kind of a way.
Can I just fucking tell you that I was with one of those people who was like, I went to go, see Poison at the Roxy.
Oh, yes.
Like,
amazing.
Yeah, I've seen so many of those bands. I recently watched a documentary on the Rainbow Bar and Grill.
Right.
And I never hung out in that scene, but the Rainbow was obviously always right there. And yeah, that was, I was involved in that for a minute, like with a couple friends of mine from high school.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I was into that. Dude, I'm just a music person. I'm just like a fucking explorer, you know, like.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was like, you know, I'm a few years younger than you, but I was so into Guns N' Roses when I was like 12. So this is like then, you know, like I was like obsessed and just saw LA as this kind of mythical place, right? Because I've obviously been there since, but like, you know, I think the first time I went to LA, I think was 1990. Actually, no, I went there on a holiday as a kid, but that's obviously not the same. The first time I turned up as a kind of an adult was, you know, at least 10 years after this. And I was so excited just to see the Sunset Strip. I mean, even though that stuff was long gone.
Oh, yeah.
But like,
Yeah.
Okay, so describe to me a Poison gig in 1988 or whatever the best year was.
You know, their sound live was way more like kind of like trashy and thrashy rather than like when their albums came out. It was more tame, more like bubblegum almost compared to how they were live.
Yeah.
And their shows were really super fun and theatrical. I remember one time they came out and they like, you know, they had all this confetti that like shot up in the air, and then they like fucking threw all these like bras out into the crowd, and the bras on the cups had the Poison logo on each cup.
Amazing. Wow.
So they were actually quite a very, very good band. And I remember being really disappointed when that first album came out because it was just like, this is not that same vibe, you know?
Right. Yeah. I guess it was a bit, they got, I guess, pressured into being a bit more commercial, right? Like a lot of bands did and do when they go to a big label.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, because obviously when we talk about this, you know, we're thinking about the kind of the big hair and the fucking makeup and everything.
Yeah.
But what was the club scene, the rave scene? Like how do people look going to the kind of rave parties early in LA in that era?
So the rave thing was like, visors, baseball caps, oversized jeans were a huge, huge thing. Trainers, you know, maybe, the top of sweat, you know, like the sweat jacket, you know, like an Adidas one or something like that was kind of what you did. Like it was, you know, and then after a few years, it became like candy rave became like a thing. So it was tons and tons of like these Day Glow bracelets and things like that and necklaces and stuff. But mostly like typical rave gear was like really, really big jeans, like oversized jeans and like a track jacket and like a baseball cap or a visor or a hoodie or something like that. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what was your first memorable experience at one of those kind of parties? Do you have a... Well, I think a lot of people have that kind of... when you first walk in somewhere, it's like, okay, fuck, this is a... this is a rave. What's your equivalent of that?
You know, I remember distinctly there used to be a ton of like undergrounds in downtown LA. And I remember this is literally because LA at the time, LA was like so different from the Bay Area in terms of like what music was being played at these parties. LA was all about the, you know, that rave sound, that James Brown is dead, that human resource dominator, you know, that whole vibe, you know. And it was all about like how big the sound systems were, and these flyers were just like, now looking back, incredible pieces of design work, you know. And I distinctly remember there was this party called the Bean. I think it was called like the Alien Bean or something like that. And it was in downtown LA, and it was like featuring Psychic TV. And it was like in this huge building, and it was like maybe, I don't know, three or four different floors going on. And it was like, I just remember that being like such a crazy party. And at one point we all had to like, there was like in one room, they had like a weird ceremony going, and everyone had to like walk up onto the stage, and then you had to crawl, and you crawled on this stage, and you would have to crawl. But like there was a woman sitting in like a throne or something like that. And you had to like crawl between her legs or something like that to get through. And then she would like, if I remember correctly, I mean, dude, I can't even believe I remember any of this, but like, I remember being like, maybe she had a palm leaf or something that she would like hit us all with or something like that as we like crawled by her. Just wild, man.
Yeah, that sounds like a formative experience.
Yeah, and then plenty of like raves were out in the desert as well. So going to like these really huge like outdoor desert raves as well. That's also a memory that really sticks out as well.
I mean, jumping forward a bit, have you been to Burning Man?
Yeah. The last time I went was in 2000.
Right, when it was still proper Burning Man.
Yeah. Yeah, have you been?
No, I haven't. I'm fascinated by it, but I don't particularly want to go there, particularly now, to be honest. But I do find it really interesting. I mean, and presumably, well, it was a direct result of this era, like that very early era of raves, right? I mean, there's obviously a bigger backstory to it as well. But did you just go once?
No, I went. Well, the first time I went was in 96, actually. It was like a year after I moved to the Bay Area, and I was a part of this collective. And they were involved with sort of like negotiating with the Burning Man people to sort of allow them to sort of set up an area with sound systems.
Right.
And so in 1996, I was a part of a collective called Friends and Family. And within Friends and Family, there was a crew called Gateway, Gateway. And Gateway had set up their sound system at Burning Man, and I was invited to come and play and hang out and stuff like that. So that was 1996. So that was my first time going. I think I went one or two more times after that, and then my very last time was going in 2000.
Yeah. How many people were there roughly in 96?
I couldn't tell you. Definitely a lot. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a small number.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I find it fascinating, but not in a particularly positive way. Well, particularly the way it's, you know, what it's turned into, you know, which is a bit of a circus, isn't it? But to go back again, what kind of stuff were you playing in your kind of early years as a DJ? Like, what was the kind of music that drew you in initially as a someone who's buying records but buying them to play out?
So initially, I was a hip hop DJ, playing like 80s and then transitioned to early 90s, sort of golden age hip hop stuff. But I got really super bored with that. And there was this guy that I went to college with. His nickname was Cactus. And Cactus had a friend. Cactus was from LA. And Cactus had a friend who had lent him some records. And I worked at the college radio station at the time, and Cactus also was trying to get a show on the radio station, and he had brought in some of these records, and I had a chance to sort of take a look at them, and I was listening to what he was playing, and I was like, whoa, that's like a, you know, that's like a lot of like, you know, like underground, like house and like rave stuff. He's like, yeah. My buddy, I borrowed these from my buddy Jason Bentley, who is living in LA. I'm like, I know who Jason Bentley is. You know, was an avid reader of Herb magazine. So Cactus lent me a bunch of Jason's records. And that was my first opportunity as a DJ to sort of like really listen to and sort of like try to mix this music. And so that was basically how it really kicked off. Because before that I had knowledge of like mainstream, more housey stuff. Like I said, like inner city and stuff like that. But that was like my first exposure to like the real like rave stuff. So as a DJ, so basically that's sort of where I got started. I ended up sometime not long after that, actually, somehow like someone was throwing like the very first rave ever in Santa Barbara, which ended up getting busted, by the way, that I had an opportunity to DJ at, where I played sort of like up-tempo hip-hop stuff and some of this ravey stuff. So that was basically how it began.
Right. What year was that?
This must have been 92, 93?
Yep.
Something like that?
Yeah, okay. So at what point did you consider yourself to be a proper, quote-unquote, house/techno DJ?
Sometime like not long after that. Like I said, I had been working at the university radio station, and I had linked up with some like-minded people, and we started actually throwing events of our own. So like maybe, oh man, this is 94-ish.
Yeah.
I mean, I have mixtapes that I made maybe 93, 94 is when I started really doing it. Like, I'm not doing hip hop anymore. I'm doing this stuff exclusively. And I'm thinking like 93, 94. Yeah.
Sure. When did you start producing?
Not until like the early 2000s. So like...
Right, okay.
Maybe 2005, I started messing around a little bit. Yeah.
So do you consider yourself to be a DJ first?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's super interesting because, yeah, I mean, everyone's got their own kind of like mental headspace about that, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't really know why I fall down on it. I'm kind of, I'm not really, I'm sort of midway between the two things. But, you know, for people who DJed for a number of years before getting into it, I'm not going to say... You can hear it in people's productions who are like that, but I think it gives you an expertise which you don't necessarily have if you haven't been a quote unquote proper DJ before making tracks. I mean, that's a huge generalization, I realize, but I mean, what do you think it's added to it? You know, that kind of initial experience of DJing before you started making tunes.
I just looked up my the first record that I put out. It was like a collaborative thing with another guy. I just looked it up on Discogs, so it's listed as 2002. So.
Okay.
That was the first time I put something out. So I was messing around with music, like producing music in like 2001, 2002. So like right after I got back from London, actually.
Right, sure.
So, sorry, your question was again?
Yeah, I mean, what do you think that experience, like, you know, pretty extensive experience of being a club DJ, being a proper DJ in quotation marks, like how do you think that informed and continues to inform the music that you make?
I'm always thinking about sort of the emotional impact, that something's going to have like for people on a dance floor. At some point of the process that becomes, you know, a focal point. So, you know, I guess that would be the answer to the question is like, it's trained me to sort of think about my productions from the standpoint of, you know, someone who would play it in a club.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that Well, I always think when I'm thinking about this issue, I always think about Darren Emerson joining Underworld as the quote-unquote DJ who was going to make their music more DJ-friendly, right?
And,
and I think there is some... I mean, there's something to it. I mean, like I said, it's easy to generalise about these things, but, you know, real knowledge of a dance floor and the way dance floors work, it's super useful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
Really, obviously, yeah.
Because I do know some producers who don't... you know, they're not DJs, or they are DJs. It's sort of by necessity, you know. And so they do have a different perspective. They're more coming at it from a musical standpoint, you know. And I think, you know, in general, I think especially with the shortening of length of tracks these days, I just think like there's more and more of sort of that sort of like viewpoint making dance music from sort of like a traditional sort of music standpoint rather than from a DJ standpoint. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, like people calling dance tracks songs like that that really grates with me because like, you know, it's a tune, right?
Yeah.
And a song is a 3-minute, you know, A, B, structured song, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, you eventually move to Detroit to work for Planet E.
Yeah.
This is a few years later.
Yeah. 2008.
Yeah. Okay. That was not your first job in music though, was it?
No, not at all, actually. I had had done some internships. When I was in LA, actually, I was an intern at K-Rock, actually, way back.
Oh, right. Okay.
And
right.
Do you remember this?
The radio station.
Yeah. But do you remember this label called Planet Earth Moonshine?
No.
Do you remember Moonshine?
No. What kind of music?
Moonshine was this. What they did, they never released their own music. What they would do was they would re-release sort of like stuff from Europe that they would license, and they would like repackage it for the US market. And so they would put out tons of like these crazy rave compilations, and like they would re-release, they would do some 12 inches as well. But it was always like stuff they had licensed from elsewhere. Mm. And so I worked as an intern at that label for a while. These two brothers called the Levy Brothers actually were running that. Steve Levy, and I forget what the other guy's name was, but I think they're still around actually, like doing stuff. But yeah, that was sort of my first dance music job. But yeah, I had other jobs in the industry in San Francisco, actually, right before I moved to Detroit. I worked at a digital distribution place where I would sign labels up to distribute their music digitally. At that time, it was like very foreign to a lot of labels.
Right, the early examples, yeah.
You know, so yeah. It's called, that company was called Iris Distribution. I think they eventually got bought by The Orchard.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah. I mean, that was the kind of pioneering era of digital music, right? Because you're absolutely right. Like people, I certainly remember, and this is a few years later, I remember Beatport first hit me up about putting our label on there. And I was so skeptical, you know.
Yeah,
I was
just like.
And you must have had so much of that, I've no doubt.
Oh yeah, totally.
I mean, labels up for Iris.
You know, to some people, it was just sort of like, we'll just see what happens with it. Kind of, we'll send you some tracks, and like, you know, they would send them like totally unmastered and things like that, just because they didn't care. You know, you wouldn't do that. Like, you wouldn't even think about doing something like that today. You know.
Okay, so tell us something about moving to Detroit then. Like, first of all, how did you get the job? What actually was the job, actually? Like, what was the job title that you took?
So the job was label manager. It was label manager.
Right.
Yeah. Carl and I had struck up a friendship from the few times he had moved, or sorry, not moved, the few times he had come to San Francisco to perform. We were either booked to play together, or there was actually one occasion where I was throwing a party called Fever, and I actually booked him to come out and perform a live Paperclip People set, which to this day is like one of the most incredible nights of my life. So we had struck up.
Okay. Hang on a sec. That can't go by unremarked upon. Don't tell me about that then, right? Don't tell me about
that. So I was doing this party with some friends called Fever. And we somehow, I guess at this point, I had already struck up a friendship with Carl, because I do remember calling him on the phone and chatting with him and shooting the shit with him and saying, hey, look, we're interested in having you come out and doing not just a typical DJ set, but we would like you to perform as Paperclip People. And we eventually made it happen. And the club that we did it at the time was this place that doesn't exist anymore. It's called Kate O'Brien's. It's just right downtown, very close to the where the Giants play. And it was a really, really nice room. It was probably fits about 200, 250 or something like that. Wood floors. And they had these huge, like really nice velvet curtains, the huge, really huge ones. So it was a nice room and it sounded really nice in there. We had Carl perform live. Actually, you can find that set online somewhere. Just Paperclip People live in San Francisco from like, oh God, what year was that? I couldn't even tell you what year that might have been. That might have been 1998 as well, but I'm not sure.
Right.
But yeah, like he was like, he had his MPC. He had one synth, which I don't remember which one it was. And he made us get him a mannequin.
Okay.
And so he had the mannequin there and he played, man, and it sounded amazing. Sounded incredible, actually. Yeah.
Cool. So sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah. So we were talking about how I ended up working for Carl, right? So I had gotten laid off from the job at Iris. And like I said, Carl and I had already struck up a friendship and we were, you know, I would call him every so often. And actually one time he had me sort of be the go-between for this synth that he bought off of eBay. So, you know, we had this thing going. I had flown out there after I did this favor for him. He let me come and like come to Detroit and stay with him for a weekend and stuff. So we had a relationship prior to that and I needed a job. And I said, hey man, look, do you need a label manager? And he said, actually, let me think about that. And so he got back to me and said, yeah, you know, actually I could use somebody. So you want to come out here and, you know, and work for me? And we made it happen.
Right. So, I mean, Detroit, very different place to the Bay Area and actually a very different place then to how it is now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was like crazy culture shock. It was like, yeah, it was crazy. Like, yeah, Detroit in 2008, man. It's like, man, it's like tumbleweeds, man. Tumbleweeds down the main streets.
I think the first time I went to Detroit was in either 2008 or 2009. So just like, this is the kind of the era just before it kind of got cleaned up to an extent, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has cleaned up a bit, but it's still desolate. It's still pretty much empty. I mean, it's still just like the population of the city pretty much is, it's actually even decreased even more since that time. So it's still, you know, at Detroit's peak, which was probably in the 50s, there was 2 million people in the city. And at last count, I think there's something like 650,000 living there now. So it's quite empty. And I was actually just there like last year in June, July. And, you know, you still, you know, ride around and you still get that sense of just where is everyone, you know? I mean,
right.
You know, downtown is quite nice now. There's some luxury shops. They even have a Gucci store there now. You know, in general, the city still is quite empty.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was going on music-wise there in 2008 when you turned up?
Interesting. Well, at Planet E in particular, Planet E had just released that really amazing Kenny Larkin Keys, Strings, and Tambourines album.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That album actually is like one of my all time favorite Planet E releases. But musically going on in the city at that time, it was a couple years before Kyle Hall really started to like become like a thing. It was like a time of like Theo Parrish. Even Omar S. still wasn't a thing yet at that point. That was still coming like maybe 3, 4, 5 years down the road. But yeah, it was like, yeah, I mean, it's hard to answer that question, actually. Like, what was going on musically at that time? I don't know that there was like any particular hype going on at that particular time.
Yep.
I do specifically remember there was, you know, Theo was releasing stuff. And yeah, Carl was doing lots of remixes, of course. But who else was really doing stuff around that time? I can't really remember clearly.
I definitely remember that being my impression of the place in that era. Like, obviously knowing a good bit about the history and, you know, kind of being cognizant of the importance of it. I mean, not just in dance music, of course, like, you know, just in music going back, you know, 60, 70 years or however long. But then, like I said, going there around that era and just being like, wow, okay, there's just not a lot happening at all, really.
Yeah. A lot of people, like, when you would go to other cities to play or something like that, they always, like, when you tell them you're from Detroit, they're always like, what's going on there? Like, what's up there? You know, like, people in the scene, you know, they would ask you that, because I think, like, everyone had this assumption that, like, you know, Detroit was like the U.S. version of Berlin or something, you know, with like all these clubs going on and like all this crazy stuff.
Exactly.
They were always surprised. Even to this day, when people ask me, like, what was it like there? When I tell them, the scene is just not that very active. It's just not, you know, outside of Movement Weekend. I mean, it's tends to be pretty quiet, you know, even to this day, you know? So.
So what was it like on a personal level moving there?
You know, the first few years was kind of hard, man. The transition was kind of rough, man. It was just like, you know, I distinctly remember one time going into a store and like buying something. It must have been something that like with alcohol, and like being asked for my ID. And at that time, I didn't have a Michigan driver's license. I had a California driver's license still. And I distinctly remember the guy looking at my ID and my driver's license being like, what are you doing here? Because it was just like, yeah, I live here now. He's like, why? And I'm just like, I just came here for a job. He's like, you came here for a job? Like, yeah. But yeah, back then, yeah, man, it was like, it was just like, there was not a lot going on at all. And people, you know, like, people were really, really nice there. I mean, it's the Midwest. People are really, really nice. And, you know, you would just do your thing, like hang out in small groups of people. Like, you know, like, I was lucky enough to sort of be, to sort of find like a local group of friends that were, sort of doing things on a level, like, really interested in sort of like, you know, the revitalization of the city. And so trying to do interesting things like opening up coffee shops and restaurants and things like that, that were, you know, of a benefit to the city was the idea. So I wasn't just hanging out with music people, you know, I was hanging out with like artists, and I was hanging out with like food people, and all these people had this one goal in mind, was like, how do we make this city a better place to be? But in those early days, man, it's just like really, like, especially coming from California, it was really tough. It was really tough. And, you know, it was kind of lonely sometimes, but I was lucky enough to eventually make some really, really, really close friends. But initially those, it just felt like a foreign place, man. You drive around and it's just like nothing for blocks and blocks and blocks. Or, you know, you're sitting there, you're in your car at a stoplight, but there's no other cars coming in any other direction. So it's like, why am I sitting here kind of thing? Like stuff like that, like, you know, just like all the time, man. Like, just, it was Detroit is a, I mean, there's no place like it on earth, man. And, yeah, I mean, in a good way, but also in a not so good way too, you know, like what has happened to Detroit is, you know, the result of a lot of things, you know, unbridled, uncontrolled capitalism, racism, and, you know, they're still struggling and still fighting to sort of bring it back, you know, but, you know, it was still a really interesting, really, really very interesting time to be there. And I was really actually looking back on it now, you know, it was just, it was actually a real honor to sort of be there to see the change, the period of time when it changed from what it was in 2008 to what it turned into.
Mm. Yeah. As mentioned, there has been a sort of regeneration of it to an extent, but as you said, it's still, I mean, it's nothing like the heyday, the original kind of heyday of it. And I suppose, like, you know, it's just a kind of extreme example of deindustrialization, that's a hard word to say, but also with obviously other sort of aggravating factors too, as you mentioned. I mean, it's kind of from a sort of British perspective, I mean, like, obviously the economic forces were felt across the industrialized world generally, and there are cities in England, particularly in the north, which were affected in a similar sort of time period actually by industrialization, which have the forces that were affecting those places were basically the same forces, right, and had the same effects. But I think, like, Detroit was, it was such a high and then went to such a low, right, which I guess is what makes it distinctive in that way. So in terms of, you know, working for the label, I mean, you know, we mentioned earlier on that, well, when you work for a label like that, you learn a lot, and particularly I imagine working with someone like Carl must be a learning experience as well, right? A huge amount from someone like him.
Yeah, no, totally. I learned to trust my gut, and to just go for it, you know? At the end of the day, Planet E is a very family-oriented business. At that time, you know, his cousin, Reggie, was doing the, you know, handling all the distribution. And his dad, Wallace, would come in a few days a week to handle the books. And, you know, Carl was doing his thing, you know. So, you know, I was the only person in the office not named Craig, you know, that was in there from day to day. You know, like I said, at the end of the day, very, very small, like, you know, it's a family business, you know, it was a family business. And so it was really instructive to sort of learn, you know, the ropes there. And you know, and Carl also had his studio there too. And so that was always really a treat. But you know, I was able to, you know, I believe that my presence there during that time really helped Carl, you know, it really helped his career as a DJ and producer, because it really freed him up to excel, in the studio and on the road, you know? So I kind of, you know, take partial credit for that, to be honest with you. 'Cause, like, you know, he had someone that he could rely on who was in the office, who was going to handle the business part of it. So it just freed him up to do what he needed to do.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I think, yeah, that's absolutely right. His profile really rose in those kind of years. Obviously he had an amazing period in the 90s, but it became a different thing slightly, I think.
Yep.
His output and the way, particularly as a DJ as well, I think, I seem to remember that being my perception of him. Actually, I met him for the first time around this kind of time. And I mean, he's such a charismatic guy though, isn't he, really?
Yeah, 100%.
amazing guy. So how was your music making developing in this period? Because this is also coincides in the period where you really started releasing a lot of music too, right?
Yeah. You know, obviously being around so much music all the time, and being around a studio all the time, you know, inspired me to sort of do my own thing. And also, you know, I think that, you know, Carl and I used to talk music all the time when he was in the, you know, when he was in the office, you know. So he was always giving me, you know, I would always ask him questions about things, and he would be, you know, always make suggestions about what I should think about getting, you know, like beginner stuff, you know, like. And I remember there was this, I can't remember how, I think maybe we did a trade for it or something like that, but like, he ended up hooking me up with this Micron keyboard that he used to have, that he used on a couple of tracks, but wasn't using it so much. So I got an opportunity to start using that. That was, I think that was, might have been like my first real keyboard, my first real synth. And yeah, just like this sort of like being in the environment really, really helped inspire me to sort of start doing my own thing, which, you know, I would like after work, you know, I had a little setup in my apartment, and yeah, just started really hammering things out, working on things on my own at that point.
Yeah. What was his studio like at that point? Like what was the notable pieces of kit that caught your eye at that stage?
I'll never forget. I don't know. He probably doesn't use this thing anymore. But there was this thing that he used to use called, it was like this control, like it was like this controller thing. It was, and I don't mean that in the sense of a MIDI controller, like a keyboard thing. It was like this computer system that he used to use. It started with an M, and I can't remember the name of it now. Like it's called like Matrix or something like that. And this thing would control, okay, this thing would control like the session that he would be working on. Like it would control the console, and it would control like whatever he was doing, like in whatever DAW he was using. God, what was the name of that thing? God, it started with an M.
Okay.
Anyway, this thing was really complicated. I just distinctly remember that. He had that. He had some huge, crazy, huge speakers. The brand, which I don't have any idea what it was, you know, he had like a Pro One. I remember that. He also has I don't know if you know this, but he plays guitar. Did you know that?
Does he really? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think I did know
he
that.
He plays guitar really well, actually. If you listen to
electric.
Yeah. Electric guitar. If you listen to, the album formerly known as Land Cruising, there's some guitar playing on that, and that's him. Yeah, yeah.
Right, didn't know that.
Let's see. Yeah, he had like, I mean, you name it, man. Yeah, God, I can't remember this stuff now. He put me on the spot, but
yeah, sorry.
but yeah, he had a killer studio. Yeah.
And a separate question would be, what have you made music on over the years, primarily? Like, what has been your kind of, you know, journey in terms of, like, the kit that you use? I mean, certainly from my perspective, I've had various different phases where I've been in the box, or I've had periods where I've been using mainly outboard. But what's been your, journey over the years?
I'm really not, like, in terms of that stuff, I'm like, I probably should be more snobby about it, but I'm not. So, like, the first...
Oh, no, absolutely. I can't stand snobbery with that kind of shit. It's like at the end of the day, it's like the end result is the important thing, right? It's the only important thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was in the box for a super long time before I ever used any type of outboard gear, before I, you know, like that one synth I told you that Carl hooked me up with. But like, even then I was mostly in the box, and I was using Native Instruments Reactor actually quite a bit. For a lot of my early stuff has Reactor all over it, because like when I was still living in San Francisco, the cats that I was like raving with and like working on, like in their, you know, like on like weird demos and stuff like that in the studios, like they were using Reactor. So like that's what got me into doing to using Reactor as well, because it was always such a like almost anything goes kind of thing, you know, all the different ensembles and all the different sounds and all the different crazy ass, you know, things you could do with it. Sort of like that was like what I really started making music using. And yeah, so that was like in the early days, and I was using Logic, and sort of transitioned to, a little bit of outboard gear. I eventually got a Dave Smith OB6.
Yeah, nice.
And I still use Logic, but I also, like, most of Night Dubbing was done in Ableton, actually.
Yep.
And actually, it was using a lot of the electron model cycles on night dubbing.
Okay.
So I was doing that. God, what else, man? Like over the years, mostly in the box, but some out of the box, like here and there for sure. There was this like replica MS-20 thing that Korg came out with. Did you ever see that? It was like, it's like a MIDI controller that looks exactly like the MS-20. The Legacy Collection. Yeah. So I was using that quite a bit as well back in the day. And like a Native Instruments machine.
Right. Okay. How is that? I've never used one of those. I've always been tempted to get one. But how's that?
Machina.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. Like if you're kind of starting out and it's cool like for a while. But for me, like now I'm on this like, I really, because I'm super into drums. Like drums are my thing. But now I'm kind of feeling like I need like a proper drum machine to like, okay, be the final piece that I need for my studio.
Nice. Well, listen, we've got a few more minutes. Tell me about moving to Berlin. When did you originally move over?
It was in 2018.
Right. Presumably you'd spent a fair bit of time there before moving.
Yes, I had definitely been out here a few times before. You know, had some pretty good friends that were here, and after 10 years in Detroit, had decided that I needed to get out of there, and was trying to figure out what was next, and it was going to be either between Berlin or Amsterdam. Actually, and I decided on Berlin for a number of reasons. Cost of living, ease of getting a visa, that kind of thing. And so I made the move.
Oh, is it significantly easier to get a visa for Germany than it is for the Netherlands?
Yeah, like the process of getting a visa for the Netherlands is, there's definitely a possibility, but it's like a lot more involved. Whereas here you can declare yourself an artist, and if you can prove that you're an artist, you can get an artist visa, you know? So yeah, that's what I ended up doing. And yeah, that's why I'm here.
I lived in Berlin for quite a few years, but I left in end of 2014. So it's been a long time now since I've lived there, but obviously I come over fairly regularly. But yeah, have you found living there?
Yeah, it's cool. I really like it. I really like the creative energy that's here. You know, you probably know this. I mean, you know, it's not the easiest place in the world to live as a non-German person.
Right. Yeah.
You know, especially if you're not used to, you know, there's a lot of bureaucracy here.
Yeah. That's one thing I do not miss at all about living in Germany.
Just your reaction there. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Seriously, man. I remember I once got my car towed in Berlin and it took nearly 2 months to get it back.
Damn.
I had to go to like multiple offices. Like, oh, it's just, I had to pay hundreds of, Joey, it's just totally unnecessary bullshit. And seemingly that's just the way they do it there. But
yeah. And you know, people that are,
sounds like, you know what I'm talking about.
People are born here. They're just used to it. But like, you know, for somebody else coming from somewhere else, it's like really crazy. Like some of the sort of like attitudes towards bureaucracy and stuff here. It's just like wild, man. But yeah, I think overall it's been a very good thing. You know, I told myself I wanted to sort of learn more about what was going on in the industry and sort of learn more about what was just going on in the, you know, in the realm of creativity in general, you know. And I wanted to deepen my knowledge of all of that stuff, and so I just felt like this is the place that I should probably be. So yeah, it's turned out okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, I mean, well, completely different to your experience moving to Detroit, right? Moving to somewhere where there's incredible heritage, but actually not much going on at the point you turn up. But I mean, I guess Berlin in 2018 was like, you know, all hands to the pump, I suppose, right?
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, pretty much, you know, the sky's the limit, you know? And, you know, the really great thing is, as an American, as artist coming here, it's like, you know, there's actually like, you know, support to be an artist here, you know, which does not exist. That doesn't exist in the States. You know, you're on your own You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So,
did you find that? I suppose I was going to ask you about the pandemic, and I suppose that's the big difference. And actually, it was the difference between Germany and a lot of places. Like the degree to which artistic people and people working in creative industries were supported by the government during that period. I mean, that was I was back in London at the time, and the UK government did basically as much as the American government did. Actually, less than the American government did, to be honest. To support, creative industries. And the German government was pretty good in that period. Right?
Yeah, they were actually. Yeah. It was almost worth like a lot of the grief that you get from just sort of like having to deal with like Ausländerbehörde and all that shit, you know? So yeah, no, I was really appreciative of being able to, like, if I didn't have that, I probably would have had to move back, during that time.
Sure.
So I'm glad to have had the opportunity to stay and be supported and be able to have health insurance at a very affordable rate and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to ask you about, last kind of area I wanted to cover was, I read in a previous interview that you were a major in Black Studies at university.
Yeah.
So that's correct,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to talk about... Well, you've discussed previously the kind of BLM movement post 2016, but there's an election coming up in the States this year.
Yeah,
right. But also, there's a political situation that has developed in Germany too.
Yeah,
right, involving the kind of forces which BLM was a reaction against partly. So I guess there's two questions there. First of all, let's just take the Germany one first. Like, as an American living in Germany, how have you seen that in the context of American politics? I suppose also as an African American. Yeah, what's been your observations?
Do you mean like the whole like IFD like right wing thing?
Yeah, all that fucking bullshit. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's definitely...
Do you see parallels? Sorry, just to sharpen up. Do you see parallels with the movements which have informed the kind of the Trump thing in the US?
I'm definitely paying attention to what's going on in both places. What's going on here does not seem as malignant as what's going on in the States. That doesn't mean that it's not as just as dangerous. For example, I've just moved into a new studio spot. I'm actually doing this recording from it right now. I'm officially going to move in. The official movement date is tomorrow, and it's down the street from the IKEA in Lichtenberg. It's technically Marzahn,
right?
And there's a bit of graffiti on a wall, like just right outside the studio, that says Deutschland bleibt Deutsch. And there's no other way to interpret that.
Yeah.
Other than it's like some right wing shit,
Yeah, that's fairly unambiguous, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And I'm definitely paying attention to what's going on in both places, and it's a concern for sure. I do appreciate the fact that there are so many people here that are actively against it. I don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. But yeah, it's definitely a concern of mine.
And then with the election in the States, I mean, I do follow American politics, but I'm obviously, to some extent, geographically removed from it. But also, when you don't have a vote, you are a kind of, to an extent, a dispassionate observer. But after Biden was elected, it seemed like the craziness was over and there was going to be, a sort of period of consolidation of sanity, political sanity. But it just seems to have, it just seems to be coming back, but worse. I don't know. I mean, is there a kind of optimistic view to be taken on any of it, do you think?
I'm definitely optimistic. I don't think that Trump is going to... there was a point where I didn't think he would be the nominee. That looks inevitable at this point. But he's not going to win. There's not a chance he's going to win. But we are going to have to deal with a lot of bullshit between now and that point in time when he actually is, officially loses.
So you're confident that Biden will be reelected?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. There's absolutely no doubt.
Okay, that is optimistic.
Because he hasn't. If you look at it, if you look at the previous two times that Donald Trump has run for office, he's never won the popular vote. Okay, he won in 2016 because of the Electoral College, but he actually lost to Hillary Clinton in the popular vote. Okay, in the 2020 ballot, he lost, and he lost in the popular vote. It wasn't even close if you look at it.
Yeah. He got, yeah.
It was like something like 8 or 10 million votes or something like that.
Yeah.
And so if you think about his support, the level of support he had at that time versus now with just conservatives, he has even less support. You know, they were conservative people, people who worked for him, people who were dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republicans who, you know, they would turn up their nose and they voted for him. So many of those people no longer support him. So that's significant. That is, there are more Republicans now that have turned away from Trump than in 2020. So if we extrapolate that out to independents and obviously Democrats, there is not a chance this guy wins. There's not a chance this guy wins.
Okay. I'm happy you're so sure about it. I have to say, I feel worried about it. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. You make a strong case for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
and he is as you say, he's a serial election loser. Like he really is. Like he has not performed well.
Yeah. And yeah, I just feel like there are so many people right now who didn't believe this 4 years ago, but now who do understand and they see the light and they see how dangerous this fucking guy is. There's just no way he's not going to win. Plus he's got like 91 charges coming up against him. I don't even know how this guy sleeps at night, how he's not keeling over from like a heart attack or a stroke.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, man. The whole thing's a fucking mystery to me.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, man, this has been great. I've got one more question for you.
Yeah.
I know you're a Doctor Who fan. What is your favorite era of Doctor Who?
Oh, my God. Tom Baker. Absolutely Tom Baker.
Oh, yeah, okay.
No doubt Tom Baker.
That's a good choice.
Second place is probably David Tennant.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
What got you into Doctor Who in the first place?
You know what? Like I said, my mom lived in England for quite a while.
Of course. Yeah.
I grew up watching the BBC, dude. I grew up drinking PG tips. I grew up fucking watching fucking Monty Python and Fawlty Towers and like all this shit. So like, that's how I got exposed to British television, basically, is through my mom.
Well, that's the good shit right there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, like I said, this has been great. I just got to say before we go that your track In Love With A Dancer is one of the tunes I've played the most, I think, in my sets in the last 10 years. So big up, man.
Oh, dude, thank you very much. You know, I really wish that I really want to re-release that now that I know how to make music better. I've just never been so happy with how it sounds. But yeah, I really appreciate that.
Great tune, man. Really great tune. Anyway, yeah, so thanks for your time, mate. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was Monty Luke. What an interesting guy. What an interesting conversation. I really enjoyed chatting to him. I really enjoyed those stories from from the Sunset Strip. But there were so many others too. So many other stories too. And interested to hear what he's got coming up. Because, I'm a big fan of his music and I'm super interested to see how he develops with it. So, yeah, this has been a great episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as you enjoyed last week's with Alex Patterson. That was an interesting one. But, I think we're done. Just a reminder, patreon.com/scubaofficial if you want to support us. We would be really grateful if you did that. I'm not going to lie. You can also fling us some loot at scubaofficial.io/support. And also your support via following and reviewing and liking and all that stuff. That would be great too. So yeah, thank you in advance. Join us in the Discord, hotfrostrecordings.com/discord. We'd love to see you there. Follow that Spotify playlist, link in the show notes to that. And I'll see you back here, same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Scuba.